My name is Andrew Walmsley, and you're listening to episode 168 of Photography Insights, and this is the show that interviews people from the photography world. Welcome to the latest show, everyone. This one's entitled Zachary Stevens, Breastfeeding Children and Polaroids. He's an artist featured from the New Hampshire region of USA. Now, Paula from the Griffin Museum put out a post about his work. So naturally, I had to check it out. And after looking through this on his website, we arranged for him to get him on the show. Now, Zach is a really lovely guy. I had a lot of fun talking with him, and the time just flew by. He's a husband, father, educator, and artist. But what was really nice was to see Zach working with his children on his Are We There Yet project. This one really drew my attention, being a father myself, and couldn't help but laugh at some of the scenes. And as any dad will tell you, if you have girls, at some point they'll be cutting your hair and applying makeup to you, for sure. So I do hope you find time to check the links and laugh at the photography too. We also had time to talk about his Watching the Ice Melt series, which has been exhibited, and it's another interesting take on the world of light. Zach has also covered unusual projects too, and one of these involves breastfeeding. It's a very authentic, tastefully series with shots of portraits of mothers with the Vermont Local Health Authority. And I do hope you listen to it. He really does talk about why it was done and the way it was done. And yeah, I have to commend him for such a lovely portrayal of a very different style of portraiture. So watch out for these areas today. They are higher education, changes from the pandemic, photojournalism, composite art, cyanotypes, why make work, expired Polaroids, and long-term projects. And of course, we always like to thank our friends of the show, Dave at Film Dev, Pete at Static Age, and of course, Steve at Chroma Camera. And hopefully, we'll get them all on soon for another little update and see what's going on in their worlds. I'm unsure what my schedule is going to be for the future. I would like to spend a little bit more time on these other things I'm trying to do, but I do like the fact I get to talk to different people each week, but it is really cutting into my time, and I really do struggle getting anything else done in the week other than arranging podcasts, editing and publishing sort of thing. So bear with me if you do see gaps, so just bear with me. And I'll soon sort out whether I'm going to go fortnightly or just keep it going weekly and just suffer. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes. But for now, let's welcome our guest, Zachary Stevens. And welcome to the show, Zach. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, thank you so much for arranging this so quickly. It's appreciated.
Yeah. Happy to be here.
It was really cool to come across your work through the lovely Paula at the Griffin.
That's great. Did she recommend me?
I think she posted an article. I posted your work, and it was obviously the ones about your children, and I think it drew me to it because I'm a dad, and then obviously that's when I start looking at people's websites and things like that, you see, and I thought, oh, I like these projects. But Paul is you know, my opinion on the Griffin, it's I've interviewed so many people because of them, so
that's great.
Yeah,
it's such a good place to them, such an asset. And Paula has been such a great advocate for the photo community.
Yeah.
Huge.
I think it's nice that everyone appreciated her. So she had a lovely send off, and I know Lou, who was on a few weeks back, or maybe not from a few weeks back now, got to have a little chat with her as well. So I know he's a good friend of hers. So it's been nice that, like I say, it's like part of my community now in that sense. Because I feel like everyone's kept in touch, and like even when I post, say, like this, for instance, I'll put a post up and say I've spoke to you, and you see the names that like it on Instagram, and you're like, oh, they're still following my work. That's really nice.
That is really great. That's amazing at how interconnected that the photo community can get.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so you obviously work in different schools. So what age groups are the kids that you're working with?
I primarily work with higher education, so undergraduate students.
There we go.
Yeah, so colleges, universities, and then I teach at one private high school in
Okay.
Putney, Vermont.
So you do even do, would you would that include mature students as well then?
So there's and there's a range. So the high school is was it like 15 to 18? And then college, typical college range, late teens to mid 20s. And then every once in a while we have some continuing ed students that pop in. I had one student a couple of years ago that was a continuing education student, and he was in his 70s. And he was mixed in with a class with 20-year-olds, and there's a couple 30-year-olds and some 18-year-olds. And that was one of the best classes I've ever taught. Just those different generation dynamics that come into play that are all coming around this idea of photography and then self-expression through the image. It was the best class.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I love it. So I did university late in life. So I was mid-30s. So that's why I'm interested, because like in IT, there's a lot of obviously like 18, 19, 20-year-olds, because they want to do it as a career. But then you get people like myself who are changing careers.
Right, that can be really intimidating.
It is. But I got used to it, and I did really well. So I stuck with it.
That's great. I think that the education system, as technology changes and the demands of society change, has become more and more welcoming for people either returning or, beginning their experience with higher education. And we'll see more and more of that over time. It'll be interesting to kind of see how it goes, through the pandemic, and also as, some colleges and universities are really struggling with enrollment and with people that are just choosing not to go. But then there's other people that, are in their 30s and 40s and 50s that are deciding that they've missed their opportunity before and they want to go back now. And now they can do it, and it's more accessible because they can take classes online, sometimes in person. I think that's a really big benefit.
Yeah, I think it's nice. I do think, like you're saying, I think the lines are blurring between age groups, and because I think before it was very much you either go to uni at a young age or that's it, and now it's becoming more and more popular for mature students to come in and either change careers or just do something slightly different, sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's really cool, because I think, like, photography wise, there has been a lot of changes. There's obviously been a resurgence in film, but whether that has any, whether that's going to have an impact going forward, I'm not so sure.
Agree. There's a lot of institutions that are just getting rid of film from photo programs entirely. So despite there being an interest in consumers, it's not really translating, I don't think, into higher education. I think that, the professors that are there and the artists that are there making the work are interested in keeping it going as long as possible. And there's certain institutions that are dedicating the time and money to it. But then there's certainly, so many more that realize that it's very expensive to run those, and that they can afford to run a digital program to meet those, growing needs easier and quicker and cheaper.
Yeah, and I think that's the big thing now, isn't it? That a lot of education bodies have realised they can save a lot of money by doing these things. And I think the other flip side of it is that's where business is,
Yeah.
and you have to be a little bit in line with it now, don't you? Because education has changed in that sense.
Yeah, it certainly has. And thinking about it practically too, is that as a budding photographer, artist, depending on where you're going, if you're going to go into a professional mode of creating with photographs, doing portraits and weddings or products for companies as a business, you don't really need to have that film background in order to do that. And even in the fine art world, you don't necessarily need it. It's something that maybe you want, and it can inform your work, certainly. But it's not as much a necessity as it used to be, particularly as the digital technology is changing to the point where it's starting to no longer coincide, as equally with film work as it used to. When digital first came out, it was very much like, very similar. ISOs were similar to film ISOs. The cameras, DSLRs, are so similar to the SLR cameras. But now we're so past that with mirrorless technology, with electronic viewfinders. What is it like? Live view exposure simulation, where you just see exactly what your exposure
Oh,
is in the
amazing.
viewfinder, so you don't have to think about it very much anymore. You're kind of evaluating on the fly, which, in some ways nullifies the necessity to go back and reach into that analog process. Like I said, not to discount it, because I feel like that analog process really informs how we make work. And I think it's important to the people that are dedicated long term to the medium is to at least have a basic understanding of analog processes, not only with film, with like 35 millimeter film and large format, but reaching back even further into some alternative processes and antique processes. Because all of it is the foundation and building blocks on how we're accessing and using imaging today.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think that there's some truth to that. I think that's a fair statement. There's certain techniques and processes that speak to our soul a little bit more than others. And yeah, I personally tend to balance them a little bit. I can't seem to stick with one thing. And when I get tired of that, then I go to something that feels almost diametrically opposite to that thing. And then I bounce back and forth between those things for a while, whether it's highly tactile antique or alternative processes with no cameras, or if it's highly constructed digital tableaus where I'm sitting in front of a computer for, 3, 4, 10, 20 hours over a period of time to edit a photograph. Sometimes it's exercising those two different places for me.
Yeah, I think everyone's different there. And I mean, you've talked about how things have changed from when you first started up and your struggles. Do you think technology has changed your perspective in any way then?
Changed my perspective.
For
Well,
your art, for instance.
I mean, it certainly, I've gone through a lot of different processes, and I kind of experiment with a lot of different processes. And the work that I do, I guess it's my primary body of work at this point. They're all digital composites, tableau photographs. And it's a way of working that prior to graduate school, I wouldn't have made at all. Before graduate school, I was a photojournalist, so I was making as objective as possible, because you can't really be objective with a camera. But these direct representations of whatever's in front of the camera for the recording of the news. And that documentary framework was something that I was really married to for a long time. And it wasn't until, halfway through grad school that my way of thinking changed, and that I allowed myself to start working in a different way. And the way that I'm working now is only possible for me because of the changes in technology. So I'm making multiple images of a single scene with different things happening in that scene. And then compositing that work together in Photoshop. And I'm also bringing studio lights outside or wherever it is that I'm photographing. So there's a pretty significant, you know, technology burden there of lighting equipment, radio triggers, digital exposures, putting that stuff all into Photoshop and starting to blend layers together and do selections and composites and that kind of thing.
That's very like hard stuff.
It's really rewarding and difficult, and it definitely has, you know, the learning curve of being not only needing to have those understanding skills of basic photography, but pushing it further into the digital editing world.
No, I got you. So,
are we there yet?
Yeah.
That body of work.
Yeah. So that a lot of that's composite, is it?
Yeah, they're composites primarily. There's a few images in the series. And the series, you know, changes depending on how I feel about it. But there's a few images in there that are more straight photographs, which, you know, just meaning that they're a single image with no editing really beyond the basic editing you might do with levels and contrast and that kind of thing. But the main body of work, or the majority of the work, they're composites of anywhere from 5 to 10 images. And you know, that's happening for a number of different reasons. Sometimes it's because I'm trying to achieve something that I can't achieve in real life. Cool. You know, it's pushing that thing a little past the point of reality. A big factor is that these images primarily feature me and my kids. And trying to get my kids to do what I want them to do is really, really difficult. And having them all do it at the same time is nearly impossible. So if I'm working with just one of them at a time, it's a lot easier to achieve that. This image is the Rebels one. So this one, there's individual images per kid. So my youngest is there on looking around the corner of the house. But it took a lot of direction to get her into that space and have her look, 'cause she didn't totally understand what I was trying to get at. So we photograph her, and then my middle, who is sitting down next to the fire with a match, is terrified of holding a match lit. So she's holding a match that's unlit, and then in Photoshop after, I put a flame on the match, so that way we could achieve that look. And of course, we never actually burned a Ken doll. That's just it's faked too. So, you know, a big part of the composite is to be able to achieve that. And then there's the added kind of lighting aspect, is that all of these images, they're not natural light.
Not very well lit,
And they're lit to a degree that has this interesting aesthetic quality to them that enhances, you know, some depth and the color and stuff like that. But it also starts kind of pushing it to this slightly more surreal way of living. I could, of course, make the images without the lighting, but I don't think that they would be speaking as much to kind of the experience that I'm trying to share within them. It's with that surreal lighting that's almost like it's so bright, it's so cheerful and happy. But then the content of the photos kind of subverts that cheerful happiness at times. And that's really kind of what this whole parenting thing is about, right? It's like it's all fantastic and awesome and wonderful and rewarding and bright and exciting, and it's also sometimes it's a total shit show and it's real, real hard. And you know, that's what those photos are about. So there's a lot of different things going on within the images to try to signify that.
No, that's cool. Don't I know? Like I say, as a dad, you look at these sorts of things, you're like, oh my god, that's a normal scene. I live in a different country, but by god, I mean, obviously the one I really picked out was You're obviously sat in one of your rooms, and your daughters are sort of doing your makeup and things like this. And it's like, that is such a normal thing for a dad who has girls. Because
Yeah.
it's going to happen to you at some point.
Certainly.
Yeah.
And ever since making that photograph, it's been a constant ask to paint my nails over and over and over again, which is just great. Which is
Yeah, because I think it's also then about the children as well, because you sort of see a bit of personality, because it's not always your idea. I bet there's a bit of natural of them in there as well.
Yeah, certainly. There's, I think that any time that you're making photographs that depict somebody else in them, there's an inherent collaboration in it.
Yeah.
It's not just yours. And these images, they have that where they're showing myself, but they're showing my kids too. So there's a natural collaboration that like they're ch I'm choosing to have them in that. I'm giving them some autonomy and asking them if they'll be in it. They can say no, and we won't do it. My oldest isn't in them quite as often because they're just not as interested. And also, there's certain things that they get really excited about and they want to do within the photograph. And we try to rein that in a little bit too. It's like, I don't want to make every photo have somebody randomly floating in it, and that's what they would love to do. So we try to tame down those ideas and kind of figure them out so they make sense, and then try to make it a fun process.
Well, I think you've achieved that, yeah. I think it's great. I mean, I think so many of them are relatable to any dad as well, and I'm sure even mums. And yes, I think even like guardians, it's relatable to, and grandmas. There's bits of everything in there, and the way you've done it in different rooms and different styles, and that you've got, every element. So, like I said, whether it's playing with indoor things like dolls and that, or you've got things in the garden, you're thinking, are they mowing the lawn? Like you said, are they setting fire to something? I mean, it's like, it's brilliant.
Thank you. I
Yeah.
appreciate that. They're a lot of fun to make. They become really, really in depth and kind of emotionally taxing at times. But it's pretty rewarding to make the work. And I've thought about abandoning the project a number of times, but then I always kind of come back to it because it's something that, when you have kids, I mean, it's just like you make work about your life. You make work about what your experiences and your interests are. And I'm in it. I'm in parenting right now. It's
Yeah.
what's happening. So even when I try to tuck it away a little bit, usually that's when a new idea comes. I'll make something new.
No, I think it's nice in that sense that you've embraced your job as a father into something you obviously I'm very good at doing with your photography. I think that's a really tough one. I've really struggled in that area. Some people are really good.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, I think that there's people that they make the work about their family and their experience, and there's other people that have a hard line that the work that they make is in a different world. It works differently. It's their outlet. It's removed from their family. I have conversations with another a couple other people that do parenting work. Troy Colby. He's out in the Midwest in the US. He makes work about fatherhood as well. And we've talked about that back and forth a number of times about like what it means to make that work and how you kind of keep moving it forward and how you prioritize and that kind of thing. His is very dark. It's like it's black and white work. It's very emotional, direct representational kind of thing. It's staged in some way, but more poetic rather than the tableau kind of thing that I do.
Yeah, that's nice.
I think you've had Kristen Emack on your show before too, right? And her work, we've talked a number of times as well.
Oh, cool.
And she's doing family as well, but in a different way. And hers is a little bit more of that documentary style.
Yeah, I was going to mention her. Yeah, it's fascinating to see the change as they grow older.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely.
That's a really clever thing she's working with in that sense. And you don't know how yours is going to change, though. You don't know how you're going to think in 5 years' time either, do you?
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah. And the other thing that's kind of interesting to look at when you're looking at different styles of work or different artists is kind of like how the production of that work is with Kristen's work, because of the style of photography she does, is that documentary. So she can photograph and make a lot of images, and then there the work is editing it down. It's not necessarily editing the images themselves, but it's kind of narrowing it down to those really meaningful ones. But she might have a lot of them. And same thing with some of the other people out there working within that framework. What I found with the way that I work is that it's really, really slow. So I've been doing this project for 4 years, 3 years, something like that. I started it towards the end of graduate school. But there's only 20 something photos within the series. But it's because, it takes a while to come up with these ideas. The ideas have to be meaningful. I have a whole booklet full of things that I'm interested in making, and some of them I go back to and I'm like, is that one I actually want to make? Is it really important? What does it mean? And then I make these concept drawings beforehand. Then I got to find a location that works just right for the photograph. And then it's getting the kids on board, if they're on board. Then we're looking at the weather and see if the weather works for the shoot. So the whole process to make one photo can be really dragged out. So it becomes this really slow and patient, I guess, but I'm not very patient, so it's difficult.
No, okay. I mean, you're not in California where you're gonna have sun probably.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, it was 1 degree yesterday. One.
Yeah, it
It
was
was very
minus here.
cold.
Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah. Exactly. I think we have very similar weather in that sense. There are things like that affect you because you're not doing a studio setup, and that's another interesting thing, the way you're doing it like that. It can take it out of you because, at them times you are still being a dad as well, aren't you?
Oh, certainly. And
So,
working.
yeah, exactly. So it's not like you can just say, right, you just pose there a minute because you're an 18 or 30-year-old model. You're talking to children
Right.
who go, what did you say?
Yeah, exactly. Or that they bail on it halfway through. And we've had a couple of shoots that end in tears. There's a few photos in the series that have authentic tears in them. Just out of like happenstance, or somebody was hungry and they got upset, or somebody did something else and got upset. There's any number of things that kind of happen.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? Yeah, kid, it's what I love about kids, and I always say to people, they're the most honest people,
Oh yeah,
and
definitely.
it's what I. It's one of my major things with them, and I don't mind like when they say things to me. Oh, you've got no air, Dad. And you are right. I can't fault that. So I go along with it and have a laugh. And oh, you've got a big belly and stuff like that. And the we have a bit of fun. And it's like, and you're perfectly right. And you never tidy your room. So what do you want?
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, some authentic voices.
I think that's what it's all about. I think parenting changes you in that sense, though. It's helped me change through my photography. It's helped me change through doing this. But also, I've been very careful that I don't mix it too much one way. So the early years are so important for your kids, that you spend time with them. So it was always be a dad first, photography and hobbies a second. And now, like the eldest is 11, it's becoming more my hobbies come first, and she works around me. So, like when I'm doing this, they're upstairs in my bedroom for a little while, my wife. because they know I'm broadcasting, as they call it. But they know it's something I've done for most of their lives. Well, not most of their lives, but
It's a big chunk of time right now.
a good chunk of their time. And they're used to it because I do it every week. So that they appreciate it. And for me, they're part of the show. They just don't come on it, sort of thing.
That's great.
I mean, we've got to talk about obviously some of your other work as well. Now, watching the ice melt. So, did you like cut the ice into specific shapes here, or how did it work?
It was a little bit more fluid than that,
Okay.
fluid in terms of just kind of like going with whatever I was feeling in the moment, or whatever kind of happenstance happened to put the ice down. It started, that project started when I was the program director at a nonprofit youth arts organization in Brattleboro, Vermont. It's called the Insight Photography Project, where it teaches kids 11 to 18 photography and cross-cultural programming, regardless of ability to pay. And while I was there, we were doing a cyanotype workshop with some other artists locally. Evie Lovett is one of them, who's really fantastic. And while we were doing this workshop, we had all these materials set out, and it was a blisteringly hot day. It was 90 something degrees. And we're teaching students how to make these cyanotypes, and had all these natural items that you could put on the cyanotype, to expose it to the light, and make these basically photograms. And we had lemonade and a bag of ice just to keep everybody hydrated. And it was in that moment where I was like, oh, we should just toss some ice on here because, the cyanotype process itself, it's exposed with the sun. But it's simply developed in water.
Yeah, which is
So,
unusual.
right. And it's actually one of the most eco-friendly photographic processes. But I thought it would be fascinating, just technologically, of if the ice is on the paper or on the material, then it's being exposed and we get the forms of the ice, but it's also translucent, so light can bounce into it and refract and bounce off the ice. But the heat of the sun on a hot day is also melting it, so it's also developing at the same time. So all of this stuff is like happening all at the same time, and I thought that was kind of fascinating. So after that workshop, I ended up going home, and I had a bunch of paper sensitized anyway in my studio. And then I spent the following summer, making ice cyanotypes in my backyard. And so it started with this idea of just like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen if I do this thing? And at the same time, I'd been doing a lot of reading, and all of my work, I tends to be really informed by research. So I'll just sit and read as much as I can about something, and then the art is the way of getting it out of my head. So I've been doing a lot of reading about climate change, and a lot of just kind of worrying about it, and watching documentaries, watching the news. I think that was the same time as the fires in Australia were happening. So like all of this stuff is in my head, and sitting there and quite literally watching ice melt. So watching the ice melt became this experience for kind of holding space and way of processing all of these things that are happening in the world, in terms of climate change and with the glacial ice melt and that kind of thing. So it started with just pulling out ice cubes out of the fridge and laying them on the paper, and then kind of seeing what happens, and doing it again, and then doing it again, and doing it again, and occasionally, you start forming ice in different shapes, and see what happens as they react, and then learning how to place the paper to achieve different results, and then experimenting with different sizes of ice, different shapes of ice, that kind of thing. And it resulted in, I mean, I made hundreds of these things, kind of narrowed them down to, I think a body of work of about 25 pieces. And it was a way, yeah, it's a way of kind of processing that experience. And I was explaining it to somebody just recently, that they're less a call to action, and they're more made from this mindset of kind of like a helpless witness, kind of a melancholy space of like, what else can I do? There's nothing, like doing everything I can, I think. And yet all I feel like I can do is just sit here and watch it happen. So there's simple abstract cyanotypes of ice melting, but there's a lot of thought imbued into them.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of doing it, without a doubt. I think it's an interesting way of using different materials as well. Because like you're saying, because you're using something that's translucent, I mean, the possibilities are endless.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, you can put, I mean, that process is so interesting. I mean, and using it cameraless.
Yeah.
So you're working similarly to making a photogram in a dark room, except that instead you get to be outside. In the sun, maybe that's nice. Maybe it's not nice. Who knows? I put ice on it for this project, but we've made photograms with glass bottles, with plastic things. and, you can do that in the dark room too, and you can see that as the light passes through it, you almost get this feeling of dimensionality when it kind of concaves on the edges of the bottle or something like that. And then you no longer have like a defined silhouette type of shape as you do with a opaque object.
Yeah.
It was a good project to make. It was a good experiment. Sometimes it feels a little bit too heavy. Other times it feels just about right.
I think it's an interesting way of using a different process. I like things like that because it, like you say, it's away from a dark room or a digital camera, and you're just out there in nature, and that's all it is really, isn't it? Because like you're saying, and I mean, cyanotype's a pretty natural chemical, water, ice, which is water in the sun, isn't it? So it's such a simple thing in theory, but how many people have actually played with cyanotype?
Yeah. There are people out there. There's some really great artists that are doing work with cyanotypes and abstract images. But yeah, it's not nearly as popular as digital photography or something like that. And it's also, for me, it was an interesting way of kind of continuing the conversation of pushing the boundaries of the photograph. So the tableau work from my Are We There Yet series, it starts pushing those boundaries of what the typical photograph is in my mind, because it's a composite. They're staged composite photographs. Is it a digital illustration or is it a photograph? And like, when is it one or when is it the other? Or does it matter? So taking that into the cyanotype work is, these are images that are abstract. They're not made with a camera at all. They happen to be made with light-sensitive materials, but they're made with melting objects on top of light-sensitive materials. Is that a photograph or is it something different? And I think it's just an interesting thing to kind of keep in mind and to keep, reminding the students. And it's also a good way for me to, reminding myself of being able to break down or break out of those boxes, as you were saying earlier.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, because I think the hardest thing is with teaching is because you're trying to impart some knowledge, sometimes it becomes this is the process to do something into it.
Yeah.
But you're actually trying to teach ideas and concepts, and
it's not hard to make a photograph.
No.
Everybody can make a photograph right now. Most of the world has something like this.
Yeah,
in their pocket at any time. So it's in my teaching at least is I mean I teach the basics, you know, shutter speed, aperture, ISO, all of those things that are necessary in terms of operating a camera. But most of the teaching is around, you know, why we're making the photographs, or if everybody can make a photograph, like what's the point of making your photograph? How does it add to the conversation, or is it taking it away? What is it? What are we doing? How are we reading all of these images that are on this onslaught at us all the time? So it's more about the idea of engaging with photography, more than like the very strict rules about how to make photographs.
Yeah, because I think that's the thing you have to teach, isn't it? That you can do anything. These are just mediums you can use. I know one of the topics that you photograph, so nursing is normal. Now, I'm thinking this must have been quite a controversial subject for you.
Yes and no. I think that in some ways it's been more controversial years after the fact than it was during the making. So that was a collaboration between my wife and I, and it was shortly after our first child was born. And at that time, so what, 10 and a half years, 10 years ago, breastfeeding was still kind of stigmatized. I'm sure it still is stigmatized.
Course,
We
yeah.
just we're just like past that portion of our lives at the at this point,
Yeah.
which is great. But at the, you know, it's a very stigmatized thing, and it's something that was frequently on my wife's mind and on my mind as, you know, being part of that, you know, partnership. So it was through a collaboration with the Vermont Department of Health. So the state of Vermont is where we're living in the US. And the state of Vermont Department of Health gave us a grant to create this series of work, this body of work. And it's because of this, this 1 week, it's World Breastfeeding Week, they have in August every year. So the idea was that they give you a small grant to help support the creation of this project, of a celebration of women breastfeeding. And we took it to where some people had done work like this prior to us, but they were doing just kind of like the beauty of breastfeeding. That was kind of the idea of what people were doing. And we took it into a slightly different realm of, it was very specifically women breastfeeding in public space. So that way it was kind of putting it into the forefront of people's mind that like the idea was that like this is a biological norm, this is an okay thing. If you can sit there and eat a bagel, then this baby can sit there and have milk. Like that is all a normal thing and it should be fine. So we it, you know, it was actually really simple. My wife was connected with a new moms group locally, and simply put out a call for volunteers. And we had tons of local volunteers, people that were totally willing to model for these photographs, all new moms. And my wife and I would go to the shoot together always, and we'd have our very newborn child as well. And I think that, you know, that was important too, that my wife was there, that we were seen as parents, that it wasn't, you know, just me as a man showing up, because I think
Yeah.
that that would have created a different feeling for everybody. We
Yeah.
wanted to make sure that it was as comfortable as possible. And we did it for 2 years. So there's kind of two different bodies of work that I've melded into this one body of work. One that's black and white, one that's color, and they're photographed similar ways, but it was pretty effective. And then we gathered the images and we exhibited them at a couple of different places, and then we put together a slideshow of the work as well. just a really simple audio slideshow. So it was just like a slideshow of still images with music in the backgrounds. Amazingly, that went like all over the world to all of these kind of breastfeeding conferences to show like what it was that we were doing here. And it was because somebody who was involved with the initial ideas for the project went to all of these conferences, would bring the slideshow, would show it, and get feedback, and then try to inspire other people to do similar work.
Honestly, it's lovely to hear that, because it is one of them delicate areas that if it's not done tastefully, it could be portrayed very wrong, couldn't it?
Certainly, yeah. And that, you know, that is just something that to constantly be negotiating when you're photographing other people.
Yeah.
Just in general. There's, you know, a big turning point in my own understanding and education as a photographer or as an artist is really acknowledging who I am and where I'm coming from and, you know, the inherent power that I, you know, hold as a white man. And making sure that, you know, I'm, you know, being as inclusive and responsible with my privilege in how I'm photographing the world. I think that's just something that's really, really important for everybody who's holding a camera, you know, figuring out who they are and what it means to hold that camera and photograph somebody else.
Yeah, I think you're right. And a few people have brought that sort of subject up to me a few times about because we are middle-aged white men, so we have to be careful in that sense. But we also have to think about it's not just intentions, but it's showcasing other people in the right way as well, isn't it?
It's representation of other people.
Yeah, representation is a big, big thing. Because some of the groups or areas that you're focusing on don't have the right reputation. So I think like breastfeeding is totally, it's, I mean, over here, to be fair, it's pretty much the same. You know, people are doing it, but it's like you've got to cover up or whatever. And, you know, you just feel for ladies, because obviously it's only a lady thing that can happen, isn't it?
And quite honestly, so thinking about that work in hindsight, I'm proud of that work. I'm glad of the collaboration between my wife and I to make that happen. And it was also, again, you know, talking before about we make work that is about things that we experience. And it, that work is very much signifies like a certain time in my life and, you know, having young kids. But thinking about it, like, if I was doing it on my own, then it would have been something different. And I'm glad it wasn't on my own doing it.
Yeah.
And even now, I think that, you know, a woman, should do that work. Like that's a work that, should be created through, the eyes of somebody who is experiencing that and exists within that experience.
Yeah, I can see your point. And that's always the toughest thing, though, isn't it? Because you might say, come up with the idea, or you might know how to do it, but you do have to start asking yourself if you're the right person, don't you?
Yeah, certainly.
It's such an important thing. And it's something I've discussed about. Sometimes I work with models, and I'm very careful what sort of photography I do because of my age and who I am, that I could be perceived as something I'm not. So, you know, I haven't tried that nude or anything like this yet, because I just think, unless I'm very, very careful, you can cause problems. And in social media now, you've got to be very, very careful, because it could end your reputation.
Certainly. And, you know, you have to figure out why you're making the work in the first place, too. It's that, it's like, as a global society, do we need more white men running around photographing other people and putting it into the conversation? Probably not.
No.
It doesn't necessarily mean that white men shouldn't be making photographs, but you know, we need to make more work about personal experience, I think. And do we need more nudes? Like, people have been doing that forever and ever and ever, particularly from the male gaze. Do we really need more male gaze nudes? Probably not. So that, you know, it's like one of those things, like, what's drawing us to make the work? And is that thing that's drawing us to make that work of value to put out into the world? You know, I don't have right answers there, but those are definitely questions that I ask myself all the time. It's like, when I pick up that camera, is this something that is going to contribute? Why am I picking up this camera? Why am I making this? Does anybody really need to see this? Does anybody want to see it? That kind of thing.
Yeah. That's nice that you have that. Not everyone does. So that's why I think it was important. What were the people like then? So, you know, all these mothers that got involved, what was their take on it and working with, like, their faces being in a public space sort of thing?
Yeah, so, I mean, they were all volunteered so that they knew ahead of time what the intention of the project was.
Okay.
And so everybody was on board. Everybody signed model releases and was good to go. And there, after the first show, I think there was two people who had decided that they no longer wanted their photographs to be part of the project in public. And we totally acknowledged that and just took those out of the series, filed them away forever kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just to be respectful of that space.
No, that's nice.
And with any project like that too, when we're photographing portraits of people, making representations of people, we gift them the prints as well. So, like, I think that's really important as well. So you're not just creating something and taking something, but you're having this exchange. So they have the prints as well as in my archive.
Oh, that's nice, mate. Really, really nice. I really love that idea of working with someone like that. Must be nice to have that backing then. Have they continued doing anything like that then since?
I don't think anything has happened since we did that project.
Okay.
But I'm not entirely sure.
Hmm.
We kind of like phased out of being kind of in that time of our lives.
Yeah, of course. You're then, in a different bit now.
right. And it kind of fell off my radar a little bit.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. No, that's understandable. I mean, you've done obviously all sorts of work over the years. And one of the other bodies of work I noticed was this Instant Friends.
Yeah.
Can you explain this? Because obviously from your website, it could be a darkroom print. It could be a sort of Polaroid, but there's something weird going on with the actual image.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, typically my projects, and most recently my projects all have become very long term. So like the Watching Ice Melt project, I've spent 2 years working on it. The Are We There Yet? Photographs have been, you know, 4 years going, I think. So it's like, you know, all these things kind of build and build and build. And I'm amazed at people who have been able to, even in the pandemic, there's people that put out books already, like purely about their experience in the pandemic. And that blows my mind that anybody that's working that quickly on a project. I guess all that is to say is that, like, the one kind of body of work that I've made that was in a very, very short period of time is that Instant Friends project. And really that it was kind of, it feels like nothing. They're just portraits of peers in graduate school.
Awesome.
So during one of my residencies for graduate school, I brought a 4x5 camera with me. And then I brought this a couple of packs of expired Polaroid film. And this is expired Polaroid peel apart pack film. So you slide into the holder and you pull it out, and then you peel it apart, and then you've got an instant photo right there. And they're all, I think most of them are made in dorm rooms during the residency. So they have this kind of studio effect to them. I brought a single light with me, but the background is actually just the blind from the window pulled down. But it looks like a seamless. And they're all kind of made in conversation. So it's this, the whole thing is about that, we're sharing this space and this experience with these people for such a short period of time. And it's such an intense experience of growth and understanding and figuring out who we are as artists. And having those conversations, then making a portrait during the conversation. So the instant friends thing is that this is the people that I connected with, and it's instant film. And what's happening with the process is because it's expired, there's these imperfections during the peeling, so the chemicals are not fluidly and smoothly going across the positive image. But what's interesting is that when seen together, that line kind of connects throughout all of the images. It kind of starts and ends at the same point. It almost creates this connective heartbeat or visual connection between each of those portraits. And I think that's kind of cool. It's one of those very, very tiny symbolic things within them. That's what that is. And then the positives, because they're little 4x5 inch positives, I took those and scanned them to make 24 by 36 inch prints, so big pigment prints. And I did it throughout the course of 10 days. So I'd photograph after classes, after lectures, meet people, and we'd have conversation of make photographs. And then towards the end of the residency, I did the scans and made the prints on campus and then exhibited it at the end of residency. So that way they were made in that space, they're in conversation about that space and that experience, and then they were exhibited and displayed in that space before the end of residency. So that way the whole community would be able to kind of appreciate and be part of it.
That's really nice. Oh, cool thing to do. You must have had that film a while then.
It's not film that I had originally bought when it was new. It's some of that stuff that gets passed around. You pick up somewhere, somebody's getting rid of kind of thing, cleaning out their fridge, because it was Polaroid brand. They don't make it any longer. I've been sitting around for quite a while. It's expired. I think I still have a pack and a half in my studio fridge. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it, but it's there.
Well, it's so rare now, isn't it? I mean, I've only heard of the Fuji stuff. So, Kodak, I mean, Polaroid, it must just be really old in that sense.
is
What period are we talking of?
when it expired. I'm not even sure. It might have been in the 80s that it expired, because the Fuji stuff was more recent. Fuji stuff was great, and it's a real drag that they stopped production on that because there's a number of people who are still using it. Now it's ridiculous. If you can find some online somewhere, you're spending some serious money for that phone.
It's crazy because I've never really done instant. I think we had it when we were kids. But obviously, I went with cameras then. So I do have some Polaroids around from my parents. But then I've looked at it recently for a few people that are really into instant film, like Michael Balin. Do fabulous work with it. But then I look at the prices, like It's like Polaroid Originals, I think it is called now. Something like that, yeah. And, you know, you're talking of £3-4 per go, per sheet.
Yeah.
And that's way out of my league.
Certainly. And, I mean, the Fuji makes the Instax stuff,
yes,
which is the smaller form.
Hmm.
And I think that's... It's not too expensive. It's expensive, but it's not out of this world. But you're getting a very, very small image.
Yeah.
And it really does have this feel of it being a snapshot. And there has to be a real intention either to use it as a snapshot or some kind of conversation about the snapshot with that. The best instant film that was ever made. And there are so many photographers out in the world that will, like, pine over this. But it was Polaroid Type 55.
Oh, yeah.
And were you familiar with that?
Never. People always talk about this.
So it was a 4x5-inch pack film. So you'd load it into a very specific holder.
Mm.
I think I might. Hold on. No, I don't have it. I have one nearby. But there's a very specific holder. You'd shove it in and you lock it down, and then you can shoot it. But then when you pull it up, it releases the pack, develops it, you push it back, and then you can release the whole thing. Once it develops, you peel it apart, and you have a positive image that you're just a normal Polaroid black and white positive, similar to the ones that you saw on my website. Yeah. But then on the other side, it had a negative.
Hmm.
And you could peel out the negative, and you rub some fixer on it, and then you have a 4x5 negative ready to go that you can then pop it in your enlarger, and you can make, you know, really big enlargements of it. They had these really wonderful borders on them because they were kind of flimsy and fragile, and they get these interesting tears in the borders.
Yeah.
But the aesthetic was absolutely beautiful. And the benefit to that really was that, like, you could photograph somebody on location with this camera and give them a print.
Yeah.
So you could go set up on the street, you could go somewhere, wherever it was, photograph, and you can give them a print immediately. And then you go back with the negative, and then you can still go and make your work, which is a lot harder to do now.
It's incredible, isn't it? That's what I feel I've missed out on, some of them things. And just like, oh my God, that really does sound and such an amazing thing to do.
Yeah, it's a bummer. But, you know, we have different tools now. Work with the different things.
Yeah. Well, it's something I say to people that I don't get too involved in too many discussions about bringing films back and what do you miss. Because to me, that's pointless. That doesn't help you.
No. That's not going to change the work that you make now.
No, exactly. No, you've got to live with what's around you. I'll just pause there. Out of interest, have you seen... Well, I think we're through the formal part there, Zach. So what I think you should do is tell all our lovely listeners where they can check you out online.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you can find me on my website. It's ZacharyPStevens.com. And I think the only other place that I'm really active online is on Instagram. And that's at ZacharyPStevens. Try to keep it in sync there.
Hmm.
With the URL and usernames.
Don't blame you. Makes it easier, doesn't it, as well, for people to find you. Thank you for that. So, as you may know, the last question I ask for you is for someone else to for a recommendation. So, whether it's someone you think I should be just checking out their work, or whether it could be someone you think might make a fun future guest for me.
Yeah. It's hard to just give you one. There's so many. Luckily, you've talked to a lot of interesting people already. I mean, I'm going to give you a couple names anyway, just because they're on top of my mind. And they're people that I kind of mentioned as we talked. One is John Willis. John Willis is a really great person and has been a mentor of mine. He used to be the professor of photography at Marlborough College in Marlborough, Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
They just closed up recently, and John's now teaching down at RISD. But he's a fantastic human. He makes a lot of social documentary work and has been making work about the Pine Ridge Reservation for years out in South Dakota. It's a really great book called Views from the Res, and he's got a number of different projects as well. So highly recommend at least visiting him. It's jwillis.net, I believe is his website.
Okay.
And he's also the co-founder of the Insight Photography Project, which is that nonprofit I talked about earlier.
Right.
And it's a really, really special place, a place that I was a student at when I was a teenager, and then went back as an adult and was the program director. And so it's been a constant in my life, and it's a place that, that John kind of is passionate about. So I recommend you and everybody to get familiar with John's work. Another person is that I mentioned earlier is Marcus Ticino. And Marcus is somebody who I've known for a long time as well, and is also was a student of John's. But Marcus is doing fantastic work pushing the boundaries of our understandings of photography by using antique processes with contemporary digital imaging, exploring these ideas of racism within facial recognition technology, and creating art around that. These ideas of surveillance, all of that stuff. Really, really great. So definitely recommend checking out Marcus. And then the other one is Troy Colby, who I mentioned earlier too, who's making this really thoughtful and personal work about family.
No, that's cool. Thank you so much for that. So I think we just need to say thank you again for coming on, Zach, and showing us some of your world. It's been nice learning about you and your children and your family.
Thanks for having me. It was really, really great conversation.
No, thank you, mate. Hey, y'all, just wanted to say thank you so much for listening to that episode. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed interviewing. Please don't forget, if you want to get involved, I'm starting to put out there on social media the list of guests for that week. You are welcome to submit any questions you want to ask, and hopefully I'll read them out for you. Whether you want to do that through Instagram, direct message, you can just click, if you click on the direct message bit, there's a button there and you can record and send that right across. But there's many apps you can do, or email me, or send me a DM on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. That's cool with me. For those of you who want to support the show, please don't forget, iTunes reviews are always appreciated. And obviously I will read them out the following week for you. And I tend to use them on social media, so that's all very much appreciated. If you'd like to help contribute towards the show, and don't forget there's my coffee page where you can submit anything from $1, pounds or upwards, and I'll keep a note on there what I'm trying to achieve as the months and years go by. For those who want to keep coming back to the show, don't forget you can just subscribe in your friendly podcast app of choice, and there's a weekly newsletter on my website, flogger.co.uk, so that's PHLOGGER, and you'll get an automated email from me, and that tells you each week what's gone up on the website. So it's the podcasts and any articles I've wrote. So yeah, thank you so much, and I'll see you again soon. Bye.